WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Something familiar, something peculiar, something for everyone, a comedy tonight. Something appealing, something appalling, something for everyone, a comedy tonight.
That's Comedy Tonight from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, the first Broadway musical with music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim. He is America's greatest living music theater composer and among the best who ever lived. Sondheim turned 70 today. We're celebrating by listening back to some of his music and to a 1988 interview with him. His musicals include Follies, Company, Merrily We Roll Along, Sweeney Todd, Pacific Overtures, Sunday in the Park with George, and Passion. He has won all the big prizes, including the Tony, Oscar, Grammy, Pulitzer, and National Medal of Arts. Sondheim's mentor was lyricist Oscar Hammerstein. Sondheim started his Broadway career writing lyrics, first for Leonard Bernstein's music in West Side Story, then for Julie Stein's score for Gypsy. Let's start with a song from West Side Story, the Jet Song.
When you're a jet, you're a jet, all the way from your first cigarette to your last dying day. When you're a jet, if the spit hits the fan, you got brothers around, you're a family man. You're never alone, you're never disconnected. You're home with your own, when company's expected. You're well protected, then you are set with a capital J, which you'll never forget till they cart you away. When you're a jet, you...
In 1988, Stephen Sondheim told me that he didn't like the idea of starting his Broadway career as a lyricist.
No, I was trained as a composer, and that's what I wanted to do. I'd majored in music, and I'd studied music on a scholarship with Milton Babb for 2 years. And it was an accident, and I wouldn't have done it except that Oscar thought it was a good idea for me to do it, because Bernstein and Jerry Robbins and Arthur Lawrence were seasoned professionals, and I was, you know, 25 years old, and he thought it would be a good learning experience for me. And he was right.
Those are the first lyrics you wrote that got performed on Broadway. They've become classics. When you listen back to them, how do you feel about them?
I didn't like them then, and I don't like them now. And there are two lyrics I like. The rest of them sound very written to me.
Which ones are the ones that you like?
Something's Coming and the Jet Song. The others are, you know, they're very self-conscious. But that was partly Lenny's influence, because he very much wanted the show to be important, and that to him important meant that the lyrics should be, quote, poetic, and his idea of poetic and mine are different. And I think what he really wanted was purple prose, and I wanted simplicity, which is what I'd gotten from Oscar. So I think the lyrics are very self-conscious. I was bending over to please everybody, of course, because I was so young. And so I find, you know, except for the occasional line, I think they're pretty embarrassing.
You worked with Julie Stein on Gypsy. You wrote the lyrics for
that. The next show, yes.
Now, in his autobiography, he said one of the things he liked about working with you is that you never asked for extra notes. does that mean, like, if you find a three-syllable word that you think is just perfect, that you beg the composer for two extra notes?
I think... first of all, most of the lyrics in Gypsy, the music sort of... followed the lyrics. That say, I would write sample quatrains or couplets and give them rhythms to work from. In fact, I never do that anyway. When I work with a composer, I've only worked with three, but once in West Side Story, I asked for extra syllables. I mean, a number of the tunes in West Side Story were taken out of Candide that were not used in Candide. One of them was a song called One, which was composed of dotted half notes, and it went one hand, one heart. But I said, when we got to Washington, I said, it's just too few notes there, and the words just too heavy and too pretentious, and at least, you know, if you give me three-quarter notes instead of one dotted half, I would appreciate it. Well, the lyric's still pretty pretentious, but it's not as pretentious as it was. And but I don't. That's sort of. Maybe Julie had that from other people. I don't believe in. I though, like everybody else, I often tend to be verbose when I write lyrics. I try to fight against it. And I remember Oscar used to set me exercises in theory and say, you know, write a whole note melody and a whole note lyric, a whole note meaning, you know, where you have to sustain a note, like you wrote a song called Who with Jerome Kern, when you, who stole my heart away. Well, if you hear that tune, it's hard to set that lyric because you've got to find a word where you can, the singer can sustain the vowel sound and where it's natural punctuation, and it's hard to do. And I think most lyric writers tend to be verbose, and I think that's what Julie was probably referring to, was that, you know, I'd been trained quite quite the reverse way. Not that there aren't wordy lyrics in Gypsy, but there aren't very many of them.
When you started writing your own music, did you feel like you were carrying on the tradition of Rodgers and Hammerstein in any way, or did you feel like you were breaking from that?
Oh, no, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein, certainly, absolutely.
What about what they had done felt like what you were doing? What is the tradition exactly?
Oh, it's a tradition. It's something Oscar really started with Showboat. It's he combined the whole European operetta idea with the American musical comedy idea. And the American musical comedy idea was, you know, a series of songs with jokes in between. And the operetta idea was a series of, you know, Graustarkian situations with outlandish romantic variations on them. And essentially an excuse for singers to let forth with large romantic or choral pieces. And with Showboat, he attempted to bring some realism into the musical theater and to combine the two so that they became what you could call a musical play. Not an opera, but a musical play. And somewhere between an operetta and a musical comedy. And that was not taken up very much by other people during the 30s, and Oscar tried a few himself, and they failed. So it wasn't until Oklahoma came along and was such a gigantic success that the movement was resuscitated. And after that, virtually everybody started to write what they call integrated musicals, in which the songs carried the story forward instead of just being respites and moments between jokes and block comedy scenes. And that's essentially what I was doing.
I want to play one piece that you've written, and this is from your opera Sweeney Todd. And I thought it might be interesting to...
It's nice to call it an opera, but please, let's call it a musical.
Call it a musical. Yeah, why would you prefer that to opera?
Well, because it doesn't belong in an opera house. Though it's mostly sung, there's a good deal of dialogue in it, and I'd say about 20% is dialogue. And it's not for operatic voices. It's not about the singer. Operas are about the singer, not about the opera.
Yeah, why don't you like to write for operatic voices, by the way?
Because they push it. They're interested in the voice and not in the material. And I'm interested in the material. And that's just the way they're trained, and that's what audiences come to hear. Audiences do not come to hear the piece, they come to hear the singers.
Well, from Sweeney Todd, what I've chosen to play is a part called The Epiphany, and this is a part where the whole character of the main character changes. Throughout the show, he's been interested in revenge against one person, and it's a kind of just revenge that he's seeking. But when his revenge is thwarted, he becomes pathological and is interested in killing anybody who enters his barbershop. He'll take any head that walks in. This is a turning point. Before we hear it, just tell me a little bit about the challenge that writing this presented to you.
Well, the piece is based on a play by an English playwright named Christopher Bond, an excellent version of this story, which has been told for 130 years, 150 now. And it's always been a kind of 19th century melodrama with blood and guts and thunder sheets, and as such it was always very uninteresting till this young playwright, Christopher Bond, a British playwright, got hold of it in the 70s. He was with an acting troupe, and they were going to put it on for their Christmas show, and they read it. The scripts arrived a little late, and they read it, and they only had 3 weeks to go, and they realized how terrible even the last version was, which had been, I think, 1956 was the last version that was written. So he said, don't worry about it, I'll rewrite it. And he rewrote it, and he changed, kept the essential plot, which is about a murderer, mass murderer, and who kills people in his barber chair, and whose colleague, Mrs. Lovett, turns them into meat pies and becomes the most successful entrepreneur of meat pies in London as a result. And he motivated it by giving Sweeney Todd this whole revenge motive, which was never, ever part of the story. And the only difficulty he had in motivating the whole play was turning the personal revenge into mass revenge, which of course didn't matter in the originals, because the originals he was just this kind of crazed, greedy murderer who killed people for their money. And that was not the case with Bond's version. And I had to figure out some reason to justify the moment. What Bond justified the moment with a single sentence, which even he admitted was sort of a weak stab, which Sweeney said, in effect, "I've tasted blood and now my thirst is great." And I'd never bought that, and neither, I think, did Chris Bond. So I try to think of a reason that he would turn from being a single-minded murderer into this kind of crazed mass murderer. And I came up with this notion in the Epiphany, which has to do with the social situation and really has to do with the lower classes and the upper classes, which is something that Bond, who was and is a sort of left-wing playwright, had touched on but hadn't used for this particular moment. And what Sweeney does, in effect, is blame the world for his difficulties, for his problems, for the rape and suicide of his wife. And, in fact, he's right. And so to blame the social structure for his personal tragedy gave me the key so that he could then say, "And now I will kill everybody in the social structure, high and low." And that's what it amounts to.
Okay, let's hear the part where he has this revelation, this epiphany. This is from Sweeney Todd.
"There's a hole in the world like a great black pit, and it's filled with people who are filled with shit, and the vermin of the world inhabit it. But not for long. They all deserve to die. Tell you why, Mrs. Love, tell you why. Because in all of the whole human race, Mrs. Lovett, there are two kinds of men and only two. There's the one staying put in his proper place, and the one with his foot in the other one's face. Look at me, Mrs. Lovett, look at you. Though we all deserve to die, tell you why, Mrs. Lovett, tell you why. Because the lives of the wicked should be made brief for the rest of us. Death will be a relief. We all deserve to die. And I'll never see Joanna. No, I'll never hug my girl to be finished. All right, you, sir, how about a shave? Come and visit your good friend, Sweeney. You, sir, too, sir, welcome to the grave. I will have vengeance. I will have salvation. Who, sir? You, sir? No one's in the chair. Come on, come on! Sweeney's waiting. I want you, readers. You, sir? Anybody? Gentlemen, now don't be shy. Not one man, no, nor ten men, nor I. And I will get him back even as he gloats. In the meantime, I'll practice on less honorable throats. And my Lucy lies in ashes, and I'll never see my girl again. But the work waits. I'm alive.
Len Carreyrou from the original cast recording of Stephen Sondheim's musical Sweeney Todd. We'll hear more of Sondheim's 1988 interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Today is Stephen Sondheim's 70th birthday. Let's get back to our 1988 interview with him. You know, it seems to me that in all your songs, you always bring in very specific elements of the drama that's going on.
Yes, well, I'm into that. I'm into sort of naturalistic songwriting. And like The Worst Pies in London, in that show, you know, I worked out where she's dusting, blowing dust off her pies and slapping roaches and things like that. It's all worked into the music. Each slap and each blow, and I like working that kind of thing in. It first of all, it helps the director to give him a very specific blueprint of what the action should be, so that if he wants to change it, he can, but he has something to work from, and he doesn't have to turn to you and say, well, how do I fill this moment? And I like to, I think it's fun to write songs, you know, for people who have colds or who stutter or, you know, who cough or who can't remember what they're saying, the kinds of things we do in real life.
Is that why you like to work in the setting of Broadway shows, because there are details of a story to work into a song? It's not just a generic love song. There's characters.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's exactly why, yes. I'd much rather write for character and situation. I wouldn't know how to just write a song, because I would have to invent a character in a situation if you asked me to write a song. The few songs I've written, like, for, I know, people's birthdays and things like that, that I've written apart from dramatic situations, I've had to invent the dramatic situation or take it out of a real-life situation.
Have you ever taken a lyric of yours and changed it because you thought it was too clever?
No, I've taken it, yes, I have, when I think that the audience isn't getting it, or when I think it's out of character. I did it in Into the Woods. There was a nice couplet in a song called No More, and it was very graceful, and it was too graceful for the character. Yes, I will take it out sometimes, not often, because I usually do that in my study while I'm writing it, when I think that it's either out of character or when I think that it may be something difficult for the audience to assimilate quickly, because the whole point of a song is, as opposed to a poem, which you can read at your own speed, a lyric goes by at its speed, and you have to catch up with it. So it's up to the lyric writer and the composer to make it clear to the audience, at the same time not lag behind them nor be so far ahead of them that they get baffled. So sometimes you have to underwrite lyrics for just that purpose. You have to give them air, and you have to make the lyrics simpler than you would if it was on paper.
I know that you collect puzzles and you're interested in puzzles. Is lyric writing similar to a puzzle?
Oh, sure.
And the problems you have to solve?
All art is. All you have to solve it. Same thing as with a painting or with a novel. I mean, you're always solving problems of structure, architecture, and things like that. In lyrics, I think it's more critical because there are so many fewer words. I don't know what kind of a... I just violated some basic speech. So many fewer words. But at any rate, there are fewer words, and therefore each one becomes important. Also, since I believe in writing lyrics that reflect the inflection of regular speech, the rise and fall of the language, and how long you sustain a word in a given line becomes, to my ear anyway, critical if you're trying to give the impression of naturalistic speech. One of the problems with Sweeney Todd was I didn't want the audience to laugh at this melodrama. I mean, we do live in the 20th century, and people don't go for this kind of blood and thunder stuff anymore, and it's much more horrible out on the street than it is on the stage. But I also didn't want them to think that they were, quote, at an opera. So one of the triumphs for me of Sweeney Todd is I look around the second act at the audience's face. They don't know that people are singing. They really think they're talking, because they're so involved with the story and what's going to happen next and who's going to get killed next, they don't realize they're being sung at. And that's a result of lyric writing being so seeming like dialogue. And that kind of stuff comes through a lot of sweat, and that's what working out a puzzle is.
One last question. A lot of composers really love to play their own stuff at parties and to get on the stage whenever anyone will let them and perform. You seem to rarely... perform your own work. You don't like to perform?
No, I don't. I played a lot. I performed a lot when I was a kid. When I was in the, when I was at George School, I played some recitals around Pennsylvania, and I also acted a lot while I was in college. And one day, I just woke up and thought, "What am I doing in public?" And from then on, I always wanted to hide in the shadows. I'm not a performer by nature, and except privately, I like to play the piano for friends, or particularly for a collaborator. I like to demonstrate a song, but I do it when I have to. But it's something that does not give me a kick at all.
Well, I thank you very much for spending some time with us. Thank you.
Righto.
Stephen Sondheim recorded in 1988. Today is his 70th birthday. As part of an ongoing celebration this year, the Museum of Television and Radio is presenting a retrospective of his work that has been broadcast on TV. And in May, the New York Philharmonic will stage a concert performance of Sweeney Todd. Let's listen to a song from the cast recording of Sondheim's 1994 musical, Passion. We'll hear Donna Murphy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I wish I could forget you. Erase you from my mind. But ever since I met you, I find I cannot leave the thought of you behind. That doesn't mean I love you.
That doesn't mean I love you.
I wish that I could love you. I know that I've upset you. I know I've been unkind. I wanted you to vanish from sight, but now I see you in a different light. And though I cannot love you, I wish that I could love you, for now I'm seeing love like none I've ever known. A love as pure as breath, as permanent as death, implacable as stone. A love that like a knife has cut into a